Okay, after an interruption of a couple hours, this is continuing with Bernie Burke on 22 September 1981. So, when Tatel died, you moved in more or less in his place on the 21 centimeter work, is that fair?
It was slow. It was an idiomatic transition because we were busy building the long 400 megahertz V's
at the same time.
So, at first it was an occasional interaction, and then it became more intense as the when the 60-footer was completed, because that was the critical point at which the focus really changed.
Was that built in-house, more or less? Or?
No, it was contracted out to antenna constructors and Blau Knox. And all we did was to act as the in an oversight role,
yeah.
Just seeing that it was done right.
Right. What were the corner reflectors used for primarily? Let's finish that one off.
Okay. We measured the positions of some radio sources. It turned out that...
Who is we when you say that? That's Firer, I guess.
John Firer. He left before the project really went very far. And we looked at the galactic center and measured the flux of the galactic center. Then it was becoming, I think, increasingly clearer that more antenna area was needed. They were a small set of antennas, but it began, in my mind, to be clearer that paraboloids were better than that type
of antenna. The only two publications I see that I think are on that are two AAS abstracts of you and Firar. So
that's right.
It really didn't come to...
We measured a small number of sources, but I would say that by 1960, my main focus of interest had certainly shifted to the 60-foot.
So what did you see as a good thing to do with the 60-foot?
Well, the first thing we did was to try to improve our knowledge of baselines, so we could look at faint hydrogen line profiles.
You had, was it 64 channels?
It was
a very large number for that.
It was approximately 64 channels. I don't remember the exact number.
I had it
number.
Written here somewhere, but anyway.
But it was roughly 64 channels.
And I don't think you had computer reduction.
No, it was a chart output. But we worked out an analog way of reducing the data, which turned out not to be too cumbersome.
That
is, we just had a light table, and if one had a sequence of integrations, you just took a piece of proper-sized graph paper, overlaid it, quickly traced one record, then went on to the next record, traced in a different color. And so you could you could stack together records pretty conveniently.
But now, if you had N channels, and that can be checked how many it was, did you have that many traces?
No, it was a step switch arrangement where the step switch went through sampling the integrated signal on each one of the capacitors, and it did it...
At a faster rate than the integration time, so you...
That's right, yeah.
Independent.
So. Yeah. It took about roughly 1 minute to read out the channels.
And were you tracking a given position in the sky, typically, or were you...
Yeah, we could typically be tracking a given position in the sky. Then the 300-foot came along, when was it, 1961?
Right.
And we wanted to look at the Andromeda Nebula.
Well, before we get to the 300-foot, I'd like to just finish off what got accomplished on the 60-foot.
Mm-hmm.
You said you had to understand baseline problems.
Yeah.
These were... What, just LC filters?
They were, the baseline problems had not to do with the filter bank, but with the RF problems that everybody was dealt with 21 centimeter spectroscopy has experienced, finding out their standing waves in the local oscillator line and all sorts of things, tracking those down.
What was your front end?
And the front end was Crystal Mitchell. And then eventually we replaced it with a parametric amplifier.
Which would be roughly when?
I would guess about 63 or 64. We copied an AIL parent, mm-hmm. and then learned how to tune the thing. And
but what did you see as a good project to do, and what did you accomplish with the 60-foot?
Okay. With the 60-foot, I became interested in the area of the Galactic Anticenter and surveyed a big area around the anticenter. I was looking for correspondence of hydrogen with the dark clouds in Taurus, and also never published the work, but what I did notice was that you could see evidence for a general progression in the large scale map, which is was a way of measuring the distance to the next parallel amount.
A progression in velocity versus position?
That's right. Yeah. And also, we had a very nice measurement of the hydrogen surrounding an OB association, Perseus 2 association, where you could quite clearly see a hole surrounded by a ring of gas. It's pretty clear. Didn't publish much of the work, though.
A fair statement for a lot of the work that got done.
Well, it was generally published in the... One of the things that we did do is try to write a very clear annual report.
Well, and as I told you, I have a set of these, and they are...
In general, I think that the main line of the research was pretty well summarized in there. I think that probably in those days you didn't have to worry about publish or perish. If you had a really important result, you published it.
Yeah.
But if it was a good continuing line of research that was adequately described in the annual report, then my general feeling was, well, that takes care of getting the knowledge across to whoever wants to find out about it. Because in those days, the annual report was pretty well available to all the... Mm-hmm. observatories in the world.
It was like an observatory series almost.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it was much more like the annals of the observatories that used to be published in the old days.
Right. But was not this attitude something to do with the special character of the Carnegie Institution, or do you think that you didn't have to worry about publishing as much if you were in a university also at that time?
I really can't say. I can't address that because I don't know what the general spirit of the times was in the universities. There were so few...
In the late 50s.
In the late 50s, so few that you just have to ask people who were there. Generally, people were starting up new things, and I think that under those circumstances in those days, there was not great pressure to publish.
Because obviously you needed a lot of time to get things established and
That's right.
try things out.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask about the Carnegie Institution as a whole. It strikes me as sort of an oddball institution in some respects, and certainly different, very different from where radio astronomy originated otherwise around the world. How would you characterize it?
Well, I think the origin can be described fairly succinctly as I know the history. Let me give you my version of the history. After the war, Lloyd Berkner and Merle Tube both were there, both very strong personalities. Berkner wanted to start doing radio astronomy, and his approach was always, let's do the biggest thing we can think of doing. And he wanted to build an enormous array of dipoles out at a field station at Durwood, so I'm told. Tube was the director, and Tube was skeptical about the ability of radio astronomy to make definitive measurements. And his reasoning, I think, was that with such long wavelengths, you'll never get any angular resolution, and without angular resolution, you really won't find out what you're studying.
Mm-hmm.
You want to know what the state of the matter is,
and right.
You may have these very words from him, because I heard that from him. That he felt that the radio waves are very interesting, but until you knew what the state of matter was, as you could get from optical observations, you really wouldn't know what you were dealing with. In 1951, two things happened that changed his attitude completely. The first was the discovery of the 21-centimeter hydrogen,
right,
where he appreciated immediately that it was a new tool for studying the galaxy, and you could get plenty of angular resolution at 21 centimeters for the job at hand. The other thing that happened was the interferometry done by Mills in Australia and by Graham Smith with Ryle's group in Cambridge And of course, the outcome of that positional work was the identification of Cygnus A, SA87, Cassini A.
Yes.
And the realization that you could actually measure the positions well enough and that the objects turned out to be extraordinary objects completely changed his mind. He was a, too, he was a person of very strong opinions. If he thought something was no good, he usually would advance good reasons for why he thought so. It wasn't an arbitrary choice.
Yeah.
But he, faced with good evidence, he was also always willing to change his mind. And so he changed his mind in the period 51-52. And he invited both Mills and Smith to go to the Carnegie Institution. Graham Smith spent the longest time. Mills made only a very brief visit.
Yeah, Smith was there for a year.
Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
It was a year and a half, actually.
Yeah.
But some of that time was spent at Mount Palomar. The other thing that the other person who was brought there was Leif Ovren from the Cornell Group.
Is that O-V-R-E-N?
O-W-R-E-N.
O-W-R-E-N. Yeah. Okay.
And
I've come across his, he did his thesis in solar.
Yeah, his interest was solar astronomy, and too also was interested in the sun, I think because he had a philosophical feeling that the Department of Terrestrial Magnetism should be concerned with the sun because of its effects on the Earth, ionosphere, and magnetic field. So, Ovren was working on the solar problems, and John Feirauer pretty much gravitated toward Ovren's projects and picked them up after Ovren left.
I see. So, I hadn't realized Ovren was there.
Yeah.
He must be in the...
That's a new piece of information.
In the annual reports.
Yeah.
Was that the connection with the array of helices?
Yes, that's right.
They were for some solar work, I see.
Yeah. And that's the... now, I tended not to work on the sun, and John Feirauer tended to concentrate on the sun. But the boundary lines weren't very sharply drawn. We helped each other at different stages.
Where is Ovren now, you know?
Okay.
Okay, continuing with Bernie Burke after a couple hour break. You told me how Tuve's attitude changed in the early 50s and why. But could you speak a little bit more generally about the nature of the group at Carnegie in the 10-year period that you were there?
Okay. I think that basically the it was a marvelous place to be to work at fundamental physics because you weren't under the pressure to produce instantly, and in fact, if you made a mistake, in fact, I did make, I think, one little mistake. The 400 megacycle array of V's turned out not to be the right thing, but well, it took some of my time and a small amount of money, and so it was no big loss. But the thing is that it's a place where you really felt you couldn't try wild things all the time. You had to do some things that had definite results, but still, it was a good place where you could try the sort of slightly long chance that it's hard to get supported in an ordinary academic environment.
And I gather that, of course, there were no teaching responsibilities, and there was little committee stuff
and
writing of proposals and all this kind of thing.
Yeah.
Now, was this Tuve's specific policy, or is this just the...
Yes, it was really, I think, his philosophy that... everybody should spend 10% of their time doing something that was almost outrageous, something that had a relatively low priority and payoff. 90% of your time ought to be spent on something that is a reasonable bet.
Is this why you're working on SETI, 10% of your time now?
Well, I'm not working 10% of my time. I think that's more like 2% of my time.
Okay. Let's go back to the 21 centimeter work. With the 60-foot, you worked in the Annie Center. I was going to make the comment that this seemed very similar to a couple of projects you described as to what was going on at Agassiz at that same time.
Well, actually, I was motivated by the fact that I wasn't very happy with what Agassiz had done, and I felt that...
In what sense were you not happy?
Well, I didn't think that their signal noise ratio was all that great and that they were trying to look for things without being critical of the data.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to see... So I was able to survey a larger amount of sky because it wasn't just as... sequence of theses, I was able to do a rather large block of the sky, and I think course, two have wanted to survey the whole sky, do the whole thing in 26 years, and in fact, he eventually did do
through
it.
The 60s.
That was after I left.
Right.
Yeah.
But you think it's a fair statement that really, out of all that 21 centimeter work, not very much science came out of it.
No major breakthrough. That is, we did look at M31 and M33, and we got good rotation curves and showed something about
that. On the 300 foot.
On the 300 foot.
No, I'm talking about the 60 foot. What was done at DTM.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. As far as my work at DTM is concerned, it was a marvelous preparation, but the 60 foot itself didn't produce much for me.
Or, I'm saying even more generally.
Well, the only thing it did really was that survey of tubes. And
right.
Whether that's been valuable or not, I don't know. I suspect not.
Yeah. Okay, now let's move on to the 300 foot. What was your motivation to go to that telescope, and what did you do there?
Well, we knew we had the world's best multi-channel spectrometer. And so the 300 foot was being just finished, and so we proposed that we would use the. In fact, we proposed to take our equipment there and to examine the M31 and M33. We actually ended up looking at NGC 6822 also. And there we came into a very primitive situation. There was no. We knew we had to track at the focus to get a long enough integration. And there was no moving feed. So we built our own moving feed and put it up there and made it work, and in fact the whole system did work.
And you still had to add together many days, I presume.
Yes, yeah. Our observing run was a fairly lengthy one.
Yeah, but you're saying you had to track to get, just because it would have been
a prohibitive number of days?
Or?
We could get a good profile in 1 4-minute scan. And we typically would look at one point for 2 or 3 days.
I see.
And that allowed us. Principally, we looked at a series 1 beam width apart along the major axis, along the minor axis, established that it was rotating the way it should, and that there was a clearly defined maximum in the rotation curve, and that there was hydrogen very far out and very little hydrogen in the middle.
This was a follow-up to the work that had been done at Dwingeloo, right?
That's right. Yeah, the Dwingeloo work didn't have a good enough resolution to say anything about it, except that there was hydrogen there.
Well, they had a rough rotation curve, didn't they?
They did, yeah, but it turned out that the steepness of the rotation curve and the flattening out was something that wasn't present in their data at all. And I think
it was resolved out, I suspect.
It was resolved out.
Yeah. Did you have the same kind of output now, the strip chart recorder?
That's right, strip chart recorder, all done.
But there was a computer at NREO in the early days, was
there? There was a computer, but we were not interfaced to it. We used our complete system. We took the spectrometer into the, well, Tuve had insisted at the beginning that we put the spectrometer in a trailer because he knew there would be bigger radio telescopes elsewhere.
Uh-huh.
And it was, I think, something of a tour de force that we were able to get it down there in a very short length of time. My recollection is it was less than a week. We went from arrival at the dish to getting their first hydrogen profiles. I'd have to look at the notebooks to be sure, but it was a very short length of time. And it was a great deal of fun because at that time we couldn't be sure that the dish was pointing properly. So we rigged up our own pointing device. We made index marks on the wheel and observed it with a TV set.
I see. It was even at that stage.
Yeah.
Were you the very first users in a scientific
sense? We were among
sense?
The very first users. Yeah. I don't know whether we. We were certainly the. We were certainly among the first few users.
Mm-hmm. Well, the at DTM, I think you left in 64, 65.
65.
I think it's also pretty fair to say that was sort of the end of radio astronomy output from DTM in a
pretty much
kind of useful sense.
Yeah.
I mean, what really led to that
There was
decline,
a,
would you say?
Hmm?
What led to that decline?
Not enough people. That is, we were spread fairly thin. Two had started up a cooperative program with the Argentinians also. And Ken Turner was a new addition to the staff in the last couple of years. And actually, Ken did the major amount of work on the with the Argentines and getting their thing going.
Yes, right.
Along with Everett Eklund, who was the engineer, worried about mechanical details. Excellent mechanical engineer. Self-taught. And so Eck worried about the actual construction of the telescope, and I think Ken took the major responsibility for the construction of the electronics.
But do you think that was a really a mistake for such a small group to
get involved? Yeah, I think, it was a mistake for our scientific careers in the short run. That is, it certainly meant that our time was divided up, and it would have been better, I think, personally, if I hadn't bothered. Now, there were some side effects. I know that a lot of my time at the DTM was spent struggling to make things work. Well, any good place, with the exception of the Dutch, who had a very structured approach, you had to struggle to make things work no matter where you were. And it was relatively inefficient in time, but I don't think it was wasted time, because you got to understand a great deal about how systems work. And even to this day, even though I was dealing with digital electronics, I find that it's a lot easier to understand the system than what might be right and wrong with the system. So it's
because of your experience.
Training, I think it wasn't so bad, and we did a number of useful observations along the way.
Now you're talking about your entire time at DTM.
That's right. But the at the very end there, that is when it was just Ken Turner and me, and we were trying to build a thing in South America and do things both at Green Bank and at the DTM.
Yeah.
It was probably spread a little bit too thinly for the size of the number of people we had.
Okay, let me just close by asking you, I mean, you're a physicist primarily. You got your PhD in physics, and you've been at MIT in physics. And yet you're a radio astronomer also. I'd be interested in your comments on how you think radio astronomy has influenced physics. Or is it just a sub-branch of physics, or is it something that's in astronomy that doesn't really impact on physics? What is the relationship between the two?
Oh, I think that the physicists have a much keener appreciation of the role of astrophysics as a branch of physics. That is, the notion that there are other kinds of fundamental science. And radio astronomy has focused on the sort of things that I think physicists are most comfortable with. That is, you're dealing with a relatively small class of objects. Supernova remnants, radio galaxies, quasars, you see jets of relativistic gas and magnetic fields. You can relate
neutron
what
stars.
You're trying to do to physicists' knowledge of basic physics in a fairly direct way if you work at it. A lot of people don't work enough at it because they get tied up in the zoology. Whereas optical astronomy really has an enormous mass of details, and there are huge sectors of optical astronomy where the details are the thing, and I think that doesn't make a physicist feel like it's very fundamental science.
You mean he can relate better to results that come from the radio kind of objects? But I think of stellar astrophysics and solar physics as being very well-defined problems that the physicist...
but they don't address the maybe they favorite were, problems of the physicists.
But, they were out of... They had been solved in the 30s and 40s.
That's right. That is a... Weisskopf has two kinds of frontiers. He calls them external and internal frontiers. And the external frontiers are where you really don't know even the basic principles. You might say that the large-scale structure of the universe has some of that quality, where you're really not sure that you have the correct law of gravity. On the other hand, if you're worrying about neutron stars or relativistic plasmas, you're not worried about the basic physical principles.
You're working out the details.
You may have to make some discoveries on internal frontiers. Properties of organization and order, collective motion, things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well that tells me what you think about the scientific ideas. Has there been any impact in terms of techniques, or is that not a proper question?
No, I don't think very directly, no. That is, the concerns of the radio astronomy concentrate, I think, on low noise technology and signal processing. For the most part, we deal in much more massive signal processing problems than most of the particle physicists, with a very smaller set of exceptions. There are some who also have enormous computation problems. But it's a rather different kind of. They're not handling as much data. I think that they're dealing with complications of multiple dimensions, essentially.
But what about a comparison of the problems of radiometry to the radio astronomer versus the microwave spectroscopist in the lab?
Oh, I think that the microwave spectroscopist in the lab is doing absorption spectroscopy, so he doesn't have any problem with the receivers. He's got a... Nowadays, you have reliable microwave sources that are tunable over a wider range.
Well, I'm thinking more during the 50s and early 60s. Oh, was there any interaction there, or did they really sort of just go along
in parallel? Well, the nature of the interaction was that I came from microwave spectroscopy, as did Charlie Towns and his students. It was a very easy transition to make, because you did, in fact, have much the same kind of technology, except for not worrying about vacuum.
So it was more people coming from that field rather than that the radio astronomy was influencing how...
That's right, not much going the other way.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Okay.
The interview with Bernie Burke on 22 September 1981.